This is Michael Cowan, and welcome to Trial Lawyer Nation.
You are the leader in the courtroom, and you want the jury to be looking to you for the answers.
When you figure out your theory, never deviate.
You want the facts to be consistent, complete, and credible.
The defense has no problem running out the clock. Delay is the friend of the defense.
It's tough to grow a firm by trying to hold on and micromanage.
You've got to front load a simple structure for jurors to be able to hold on to.
What types of creative things can we do as lawyers, even though we don't have a trial setting?
Whatever you've got to do to make it real, you've got to do to make it real. But the person who needs convincing is you.
Welcome to the award-winning podcast, Trial Lawyer Nation, your source to win bigger verdicts, get more cases, and manage your law firm. And now, here's your host, noteworthy author, sought-after speaker, and renowned trial lawyer, Michael Cowan.
Today I have a good friend and someone who's been probably more than you know, a source of inspiration and change for the good in my life, Michael Leeserman. Michael, how are you doing today?
Oh, I'm doing even better after hearing that. Thank you, Michael. That means a lot from you because you're a good friend.
Well, you're welcome. And it's all true. Michael, this is your second time on the show. For those that don't know you, you are one of the very top. And when I say very top, I say at most top two, if not number one, trucking lawyer in the country. Also written a trial guides book, The Zen Lawyer. You put on workshops on the methods on how you have done your life and your practice. Co-founder of the Academy of Truck Accident Attorneys, I think first chair of the AHA Trucking Litigation Group. We can go on and on, but just a wonderful resource to have here. How are you doing today? I just asked you that. Let me rephrase that. What would you like to talk about today?
You know, that was a perfect seg because we get into habits. How are you doing today? Or for trial lawyers, what were the harms and losses? Or pain and suffering? Or there's these phrases that just come out. And I'm not being critical. Like, I get it. I do it too. And so what I try to do a lot is just watch those things and figure how can we change them. And one that I've been talking about for, boy, over a decade is that phrase, harms and losses, right? So I think that that came from a really good place. It came from a reaction to pain and suffering, pain and suffering, pain and suffering. You know, I would try to change it up and say suffering and pain because you don't want things to just be routine. You want them to have meaning. People look for something that's meaningful. Jurors look for something that isn't just this rote recitation. So for a long time, I've thought about words. Words aren't the most important thing we bring. Far from it. Our presence is more important, but the words are important. And so I've been talking about, let's not talk about loss. Let's not talk about someone lost their legs. Let's talk about someone took their legs, something that's more active. And as I've thought about that, it struck me that that's more than a word change, that this really can inform fully the way that we think about cases, think about trial, and what are cases after, how we think about what happened, right, when someone did something wrong. So love to talk about that a little bit.
Absolutely. You spoke on that, I think, at the ATA symposium last fall. I think either you spoke on it or we had a conversation on it. I know I spoke to you about it.
I did speak about it, and it continues to evolve like everything we do. So the simplest way I can describe it is if you're like me, you've lost your phone, right? Have you ever lost your phone?
Yes.
And that sucks, right? You don't like to lose your phone. And if someone comes in and takes your phone, or you're on the street, someone steals your phone, that feels a lot different, doesn't it, than you just losing your phone? And that's the difference between a wrongdoer taking something from you and you losing it. So we're so into this language of what were the losses? What did you lose? And this is especially true. It's true in every case. It's especially true when we're talking about admitted liability cases. For a lot of lawyers, they have a method that they'll follow. They'll have a usual structure I don't like doing that, but I understand that people will fall into, here's a structure. And what I hear a lot is, oh, I have this usual way of A, B, C, D in my opening. What happens when they admit liability? What happens when I argue to the judge, oh, but we have to talk about what happened? And the judge says, no, it's a mistrial if you do. I'm going to give them one sentence and you talk about what the court would call damages. I don't really like that word. So what do you do then? And one of the things that you can do is link the wrongdoing to what happened. So if we call it a loss and we say, in this case, Jane lost her daughter. Well, that's a lot different than saying, in this case, you have to return the value of what was taken. Well, that's passive. We can do better than that. In this case, you have to return the value of what ABC Trucking took from Jane, or what Dr. Johnson took from Jane, or, you know, whoever the wrongdoer is. So it's not just that word choice, although the word choice informs how we think. So it's starting to think about the difference between losing our phone and someone taking it. Someone took something, right? And we can talk about in a minute what they took, because when you start thinking about what they took, there's different levels. But just that there's an active wrongdoer, the taker, and what did they take, really changes the way of thinking. And I think it changes the way jurors hear it, because we understand there's something wrong about taking something from someone. And when you take it, that also informs the language not to award damages for a loss, very passive. An award is something we think of for winning the Olympics, not for having a, you know, something horrible happen to you. So once something's taken, if I take your cell phone from you, then the honorable thing to do, the legal thing to do, is for me to return to you the value of what I took. And when we start thinking that way, then we can talk to a jury about, well, XYZ Trucking Company took such and such. Now your verdict has to return the value of what they took.
I've not thought of this before, but when you first said, you know, Jane lost her daughter, the first thing the little voice in the back of my mind said was, well, why wasn't she watching her more carefully?
Yeah, when you just said it, Jane lost her daughter, where my mind went hearing you say it was in the big mall.
Yeah.
There's a little girl in Lost and Found looking for her mother. Right.
And so we want to rewards, give someone an award because they weren't paying attention. And you say that, and it sounds funny when we're, it's not funny that someone would have lost their child, but I mean, we're talking about it lightly, but when you have those subconscious thoughts, because you do have that defensive attribution with it. This wouldn't have happened to me. They lost their daughter because they didn't teach her to drive well enough, or because they didn't pay good enough attention, or because why was she even on the road at this time? I mean, there is all this thing that can come up. And I think when we use the, I don't want to say wrong words, because a lot of people are using them, but if we're not careful with our word choices, we can kind of push people down a road that we did not, it does not benefit our clients for them to go down.
Yeah, I agree. Absolutely. So when we get into saying, oh, well, what are the harms and losses in this case? I would correct that and say, what did the wrongdoer, what did ABC Trucking do, and what harm did they cause, and what did they take from Jane? So that just sounds a lot different. And then when we start thinking about, well, what did they take, then there's different levels. What most lawyers do is they think about a medical diagnosis. They think about, this is a herniated disc case, this is a meniscal case, this is a death case. You know, that's how we define things. And I would suggest that we can get deeper and deeper in our analysis. So you can go from the medical diagnosis and instead start thinking about function would be the next level. So it's not just a herniated disc case, it's a neck pain case. Maybe that's the problem, is there's pain. Or it's not just a meniscal tear in the knee, it's Jane now can't fully bend her knee, right? So this is going from the diagnosis to the function. Now the language is ABC Trucking took Jane's ability to bend her knee. It still doesn't quite get us to dollars, which is our system, right? That you have to give a verdict of money. That's how we show value in our civil system. So beyond the diagnosis and the function, we can start going to activities. This is where people really can relate, right? Jane can no longer coach her daughter's Little League team, you know, that she loves doing. And there's really a deeper level than even that. And that's really the state of being. When you affect someone's very existence, this is when you affect someone's dignity many times, when you affect their honor, perhaps. In a death case, when a wrongdoer has killed someone, we shy away from the active words, and I understand why we do that. You know, we don't like to say that someone was killed. We like to say that there was someone who's deceased. And when you're talking directly to somebody, I get that. You don't want to be harsh. And there's also something that's important about being direct. So in this case, ABC's choices killed Jane's daughter. ABC Trucking's choices took from Jane. So then what are the different things? There's the activities, you know, her ability to play softball with her, baseball with her. And then at the deepest level, there's the existential. There's the state of being. There's the love. ABC Trucking's bad choices took Jane's time, Jane's love, her daughter, from her. And your job is to put a value on that, jury. So that language, again, if you're even in an admitted liability case, you don't have to get into what the bad choices were. You can talk about your sole job in this case is to put a value on what ABC Trucking took from Jane. What is the value of those harms and what was taken? So I love that I've been talking to lawyers about this, and people right away, when it clicks, people say, yeah, I get that. You and I were talking about that before we came online. You can start rewriting your closings, and it just makes you think about things a little differently. So I hope that's of some help to the listeners and the viewers.
It's great help to me. I think it's one thing I love, and I've learned some of this from you and from other people, is, you know, the case is about what we think it's about, what we choose to make it about. And so it's so, let's just say I've done, I don't know how many herniated disc cases, that's what you would call them, or spine injury cases. And there's always a fight. Did this particular trauma cause this disc to be herniated, or was it already an old disc? And you get into all this stuff. And you know, I was talking to some lawyers at my firm the other day, and I said, look, there's not going to be a question on the jury charge that says, did the crash cause a herniated disc? The question would be, you know, what sum of money paid now in cash would reasonably compensate somebody for their, you know, I forgot what the exact language is for but I think that we can go instead of just asking the doctor. Now, we'd have to prep the doctor first, saying, you know, what injuries did so-and-so sustain? Is it, what did they take from her with respect to her neck? What did they take from her when they crashed into her vehicle? Well, she's been in pain, so you no longer have the ability to live pain-free. They've taken away some of her ability to move her neck. And what are the consequences of that? Well, when driving, it's going to be more dangerous because it's harder to see what's to the right. And just go from there. It's going to be harder to sleep at night. What are the consequences of that? And so what else have they taken from her? And I just think, and when we frame our questions differently, if we can get the witness to go with it, I think can really change the way. And then I don't care whether it's a herniation or an aggravation or a facet or a strain that never heals. All I care about is, this was their life before, and they took these parts of that life away from that person.
I think you're absolutely right. I think it's a great example, the so-called herniated disc case. I love talking to other lawyers, and they'll say, oh, this herniated disc case, and we're going to go to trial. And I think what you said is absolutely right. We can talk to the doctor about what was taken. And I also think it's important to know that the doctor is not the important witness in that case. So many times, and you're right, that we get to decide what the trial's about. So many times we'll fall into the trap, and I know I did this early in my career. I've taken several herniated disc cases to trial, and I would fall into the trap. They would say, well, this crash didn't cause the herniation. So this is where the question, what is it they took? What is it of value that they took? And really think about that. What the other side took, what the wrongdoer took, is not that they herniated a disc. That just can't be it. As a matter of fact, specifically in disc cases, we know that over the age of 40, the majority of people have degenerative disc disease. So I'll usually do, in those kind of cases, I've done 20-minute direct examinations of the doctor. And I love, the whole case is made on the defense doctor. You don't need to disagree with the defense doctor. The cross-exam, I can tell you what I would do. Well, stop thinking it was a herniated disc case. You know, what's the functional loss, the neck pain? What's the activities that were taken? And there I use loss. What was taken functionally? the ability to use your neck without pain. What activity was taken? Well, Jane can't play Little League with her daughter. Let's just stick with the herniated disc here. And how does that affect her life? And what about when we have a case where Jane can't return to the job that she works at to support her family? Well, then what they've taken is her dignity, her self-worth, her ability to provide for her family. So who cares if the crash herniated the disc or not? What matters is, was there pain before? Was Jane able to work before? And can she work now? And so I like to say, defense doctor, let's start with, we can agree that the majority of people, the majority of us, people over 40, maybe there's some jurors under 40, but the majority of us have degenerative disc disease. We know that from all the medical journals, that over 50% of us have degenerative disc disease, right? Yeah. And so we know, just knowing that Jane was 45, that likely, more likely than not, she has degenerative disc disease. Yeah, that's right. And what degenerative disc disease means is you can have osteophytes, right? Yeah, osteophytes, a little bumpy bone, right? A little bone spur. As we get older, we get bumps on our bones. Yeah. And it also, degenerative disc disease means disc desiccation, which means dried out discs. As we get old, we dry out, our discs dry out. Yeah. That's degenerative disc disease. Most of us have it. And Jane had it. And she never had pain. And what's important, the studies show that the majority of us who have this degenerative disc disease are asymptomatic. We don't have symptoms. We don't have pains. That's what the studies are done of people without neck pain. So whether this crash caused the herniation, whether she had degenerative disc disease or not, do you see any medical records that showed she couldn't work before, that she had pain before? Okay, thanks very much. End of question. And I had a case like that I took to trial, and it was about the dignity they took from, it was a truck on truck, another truck driver, and the jury returned a verdict of $10,988,000. And that was because I made it a case about the dignity that was taken from somebody and not just about the herniated disc. I didn't talk about herniated discs hardly at all. I didn't even think I mentioned that word in maybe once in the opening, if that. That just wasn't what the case was about. So we get to choose what our cases are about, and don't fall into the same old thing. Look at what is the value, what's really of value that the wrongdoer took from your client.
You know, and conversely, I used to, on, let's say we had a neck injury case and the person had surgery. I would, in every case, I would pay a company to make a colorized version of the MRI so the jury could see that herniation. And then, you know, the surgery was important. So we would do a little animation showing step by step what happened in the surgery. And we spent all this money and we'd talk about the surgery and we spent all this energy, you know, justifying the surgery. And the jury would give us the amount of money it took to pay for the surgery and not a whole lot else. And when I learned to, like, it's not about the medical treatment, it's about the human law taking what was taken from the human. I almost said human losses, but I'm learning. I'm going to have to add that to my swear jar. It's going to be an accident, subsequently occurrence. Now I'm going to have to add a loss, but what it's about the human, that what was taken from the human. And, you know, and I think when you do your list, especially with conservative jurors, freedom is something that was taken. They took away her freedom to choose whether to do this or not, or freedom to make these decisions.
I love it, including freedom there. And one thing I would add, and it was great to hear you say, oh, you know, the loss, no, what they took from her. And I would say that we want to change the way we think, and we want to think actively. And also, don't beat yourself up over it. You know, if you're in front of the jury and the word loss comes out, then okay, it comes out. That's fine. And I say that because I've seen lawyers in trial who would correct themselves. Well, you have to give money for the pain and suffering, or the harms and losses. These are things that we internalize, the active taking. The words matter, but you don't need to, in front of the jury, kind of correct yourself. So I think that as we build that habit, and as we are talking, you know, I'll correct myself, you'll correct ourselves. It's more of just the attitude that you're taking into the jury, and to remind yourself, this wasn't lost. You know, and to really be a mouthpiece for our clients, to champion their cause, we need to feel some of that. This was taken from them. We're here to get it back. And I also think that you internalizing that, or get the value of that back, is helpful with the client, right? We never want to be there being defensive or feeling like we're apologizing. No, we're here. You took something. We're here to force the jury, to hold them accountable, for the jury to tell them they have to return the value of what was taken.
Each year, the law firm of Cowan Rodriguez Peacock pays millions of dollars in co-counsel fees to attorneys nationwide on trucking and commercial vehicle cases. If you have an injury case involving death or catastrophic injuries and would like to partner with our firm, please contact us. You can reach DeLisi Friday by calling 210-941-1301. Or send an email to DeLisi@CowanLaw.com. That's DELISI @CowanLaw.com. She will coordinate a time for Michael Cowan to speak with you in person or by phone to discuss the case in detail and see where we can add value in a partnership. And now, back to the show.
I think even in a non-admitted liability cases, the jury's going to have to answer the negligence question. I think this concept, and I started going down this actually when I did a podcast with Mark Mundell, who talks about case framing, that we too often, like, okay, we all learned we need to establish the defendant's wrongdoing before we talk about what was taken from the plaintiff, because if not, it sounds like we're asking for sympathy, or you get more likely to have defensive attribution. And so we would get, at least I would get this habit of phase one of the trial, we're talking about what the defendant did wrong, what they did wrong. Okay, the jury's got it. Now we're talking about, back then, harms and losses, and we don't mention what the defendant did again. We don't tie them together. And I think now, you know, I try to, when I'm asking the question of the doctor, okay, now, when Acme Trucking's driver slammed into the rear of Paul's vehicle, you know, I was saying, what did it do to his neck? Now I have to start thinking, what did it take from him? I got to work on my wording. And it's not always the most, you know, you're not necessarily going to get an A+ from your English teacher by some of the sentences you come up with. But it communicates the message, and it ties the wrongdoing to what was taken. And I think that's really important.
Yeah. And again, there's no magic to the word take. I mean, it's an important word, but if the sentence comes out more naturally, doctor, when Acme Trucking rear-ended Jane, what did it do to her body? You know, and so when the Acme truck rear-ended her, that took from her ability to garden and to do this and to coach Little League, right? Right. It doesn't have to be that every sentence is that, right? But you picked up on something really important. It's more about linking the wrongdoer with the wrong, with the harm and what was taken. So yeah, that's great advice.
And just, you know, think of the psychology of it. Now we're no longer worried about a lawsuit lottery or overcompensating someone, jackpot justice. We're looking at, when you take something, you either have to give it back, and if you can't give it back, you got to pay for what you took. And that makes sense. That's more just than, you know, someone's in pain, they deserve a lot of money. Well, why? I'm in pain all the time. Yeah, I don't.
Exactly. So that ties back into, we're not looking for an award. That sounds like a handout.
Yeah.
We're looking to return the value of what you took. Now, sometimes it's super tragic. They took someone's life, not just someone's, but Jane's daughter, who she loves very much. And her daughter, who loved her very much. And you have this incredibly difficult task of putting a value on that. But that's what you swore to do when you took your jury oath. So that's what you have to do, is put a value on it. And again, it's not put a value on Jane's loss. It's put a value on Acme Truck's actions and what they took from Jane. Put a value on what Acme Trucking took from Jane. And what they took was the most important thing, the love, the time together.
So I'm just trying to think of this from and I'm being very selfish because I have some trials hopefully coming up. And so you look at, you know, what someone had before, what was taken from them. So the first thing I'm thinking, brainstorming session with my trial team, okay, what did they take from Jane? And then talk to Jane about that. Does this ring true? Talk to her, you know, the friends, family members, coworkers, whoever we can find, what was taken from her. And then we got to go back to then, what did she have before? Now, can we find any photos, any videos, any images showing what she had before, what was taken for her, so that the truth of it. I just think there's something when a jury sees a photo, or even better, a video of someone doing what was taken from them, whether it be gardening, playing with their kid, it just becomes so much more real and so much easier for lay witnesses to talk about when they have that backup. They get less nervous.
Yeah, I agreed. I spend a lot of time with my clients in their house, looking through photos, looking through any more cell phone videos. And what I'm always looking for are the activities, the time together, the figuring out what that story is. So what many times clients will give you, if you don't sit down with them, are the portraits, right? It's the picture, it's the portrait of the graduation, this, you know, with the background that's contrived, or the, you know, family portrait, or standing around the Christmas tree. That's all good, but there's better. The better is the picture of Jane at home base as her daughter is, you know, sliding in, and she's, or whatever. I mean, maybe you don't get it that good. Maybe you just have Jane standing there with the daughter striking out. Who cares? Yeah. But those activities are important. And then that lets you start talking about things that the other side can't really cross-examine on. And that's the value of that. What's more important than the time you spend with your kid, with your loved ones, with your spouse, with whomever? It also then makes us start thinking about time together, right? Because it's the activities, but like I said, there's something deeper than that. And that's like the state of being. That's the freedom, the love. And really, in death cases, it's time with somebody else. And so something that, well, you and I have worked on, Michael, what I call companioning, was something that I learned from Rinzen Roshi, a Buddhist priest who's a good friend of mine, who teaches other priests pastoral counseling. So you go into the hospital, someone's in hospice, what the heck do you say to them? You know, what can you do? This is really close to my heart right now. My mom's in the hospice, and I...
Sorry.
Yeah, you know, it's part of life, and it hurts really bad. And I saw her yesterday, and I wanted to do what I always have wanted to do as a lawyer, what I wanted to do as a son, and I want to fix, right? What can we do? And I've done that. I've been through that. What medications? What can we do? What more can we do? And yesterday, I went and saw her, and I made myself think of this. I made myself think of the idea of companioning is being present to another person's pain. It's not about taking away the pain, because we can't. When a client's kid's been killed, we can't take that pain away. For my mom, I was talking to her, Mom, I wish you weren't in pain. I wish there's something I could do. And then I realized, I put myself in her position, because she could hear me. She can't really talk right now. And I just held her hand and she squeezed it. And I sat there a lot longer than I intended, just being there with her. And it meant a lot to me. And I think I know it meant a lot to her. So that's the same thing we can talk about at trial. Jurors understand that. There's nothing you can do to fix Jane's hole in her heart, but we can let her know we're here with her, right? And this is before trial. It's not all about trial. It's about our relationship with our clients. So I ask people to give this a try. Please trust me. I now do this regularly, and my cases have a lot of, mostly death cases. So I'll be on the phone with someone whose spouse, whose child has been killed. And I try to talk about 5% of the time and let them talk 95% of the time. Maybe on some days it has to be 10% of the time, but it's sure not 50% of the time, and it's surely not 90% of the time, which is what I used to do, and I think a lot of us as lawyers do. And it will amaze you, I promise you. I'll be on the phone with someone for a half an hour, and I'll say maybe 20 words. Oh my goodness, Jane. Oh, Jane, I can't imagine. Yeah. Yeah, we did file the lawsuit, and we'll keep you updated. But how are you doing? Yeah. Oh, yeah, dumb question. Okay, thanks. And they might be talking for 25 minutes, and that's all that I say is about 30 seconds worth of stuff. And I've really had it where I've said maybe 5 words, and at the end they'll say, thank you so much. They won't say so much, thank you for listening. They'll say, thank you so much for this conversation. Thank you for making me feel better. And you might think, well, what did I do? You know, I'm a lawyer. I want to call you and say, here's this motion we want. I mean, we need to do those things too. But just on the level of connecting with someone, be quiet, listen, and listen actively, take it in, and know that you can't fix it, right? Don't say stupid things like we all do, well-intended, but the pain will go away over time, or I know how you feel. No, I don't know how you feel, thank goodness. I don't want to know how you feel. And I'm here for you. That's it. And when you start to recognize that, being present to others, it also helps you to be able to talk about it. So first of all, it builds the relationship with your client. It helps you in talking, prepping them for depositions. And then it helps you talk to a jury. Because really, especially in a death case, how do you talk about putting a value on that? If you don't say something like, this is twisted, you know, this is putting money on the value of someone's love, is doesn't feel right at first, at least maybe not until we start talking about it. If you can't recognize that, then you haven't really thought it through. I think that that's so important. And then when we're talking about cases that you would say were freedom taken by the wrongdoer, not herniated disc case, when you start thinking of it as the value of the freedom was taken, or Acme Trucking took dignity or took love, then the same thing. You have to start being able to feel and communicate what's important, and that we cannot fix this. We can do the best we can. Now, freedom's an interesting one. Can money maybe help someone get better prosthetics, allow them to travel? And if it means they need a $100,000 wheelchair to go into the woods like they used to love to do, then okay, this money does give them freedom. Then that's great when you can really find a direct way that it can help restore dignity, return the value of freedom in a real way, and actually return the freedom and not just the value of it.
Yeah, I think one of the sources of self-imposed suffering in my life has been my need to fix. And I've actually done a lot of work on codependency and feeling like I'm responsible for everyone else's problems, and, you know, even putting myself in unhealthy situations to try to help other people's problems. But letting go of that responsibility to fix something that can't be fixed and just being there for somebody, I think, helps us handle the weight of what we do and who we, you know, the suffering of all these other people around affects us emotionally and psychologically. And I think learning to companion rather than trying to fix or trying to make their pain go away or alleviate their pain by coming up with the right words, or I think can maybe help that.
I think it definitely can help that. And you and I have talked, I mean, we're friends. We've talked about, you know, how this is in each of our lives personally affected us. And And that was part of the impetus of where this came from, right? That you and I were talking about. What about this empathetic distress? What about the pain that comes because I want to fix everything and I can't? And what about the pain that comes when I so internalize? And how can I not take that on? Because what I want to do as a lawyer, and this is where the concept of a Zen lawyer comes in, what my goal is to reduce suffering in the world. And that includes reducing suffering in my own life, right? So it's not good for me just to try to help everyone else and then I suffer. I don't mind suffering a bit. I don't mind being in some pain a bit to help others, but not to the point that I can't function or not to the point that it's overwhelming. I don't want that. So how do we do that? And I think that the first step is to realize I can't fix it. Because if your goal is to fix, you're going to continue to get crushed.
Yeah.
There's some things that can't be fixed.
And just learning to accept that, which for me has been difficult. It's a journey. I'm not 100% of the way there yet. It's been a journey, but it's something that I've been working on. And as I've been working on it, my cycles of ups and downs throughout my career, as far as feelings, you know, which were, I think, definitely affected by, you know, you're dealing with really heavy stuff. And it would often be after a case resolved, like for a lot of money, I would be really down. A part of it was because I worked so hard on something and then I had more money to make, but my life hadn't really changed. I think another part, though, was that it felt incomplete because I felt like I was supposed to fix somebody and all I did was get them money. I didn't fix anything. And I think now I settle cases and I'm okay with it. And I don't get real down afterwards. And I think it's because I'm not taking on that responsibility to fix anymore. I got hired for a job. I'm being very human, very compassionate about how I'm doing that job. But my job was to get them as much money as I could on the case. And I did. And I'm okay with that.
I hear that. And I agree with that, that that's part of what we have to recognize. And I wonder, because I know you, and I know you handle a lot of very tragic cases like I do and deal with people at really the worst times in their life. So I'm curious if we can get a little more intimate, like how that, not just, well, I have a job to do and I'm doing the job, because I know you better than that. I know you care a lot and I do too. So I'm curious to talk a little bit about how you have been able to be there with people's pain in addition to saying, well, this is a job and, you know, I'm here to get the money, but what more do you do?
Well, I definitely need to feel their pain to share their pain. And so I do take time with the client, and not just the client, but the other people who know and love them. And like you said, do a lot of listening. And it's not just about the pain, because to know what was taken, you know, I have to know what they had. And so there's actually a lot of joy, a lot of laughter, because we're going into the happy time before, and we're talking about those times. I think just accepting it for what it is. I think the biggest thing is reminding myself, I didn't do this, so I don't have to fix it. My job is not to do that. My job is to be here, to listen, to learn, to share with this person and honor what has happened, honor what they had before, honor their loss. And I just think it's not that, yeah, I don't want to make it sound like, well, I just have a job to do. I've seen the two extremes in lawyers and they do big cases. I've seen I became an emotional wreck and would get depressed and would get down and turn to eating or drinking or whatever else to try to numb myself. And then I've seen that just people become callous and they just detach themselves from the emotion. Neither one is healthy. And so I think the accepting that suffering exists, whether I want it to or not, and if it's not suffering that I caused, then I don't have to feel guilty about it. And I don't have to I'm not 100% responsible for making it go all the way away. I can't fix it, but this is where I can help. And I think part of how we help is money, because that's what we're hired to do. I think part of what we help do to help, and I think I really got this at the last death case I tried, was when someone is heard, and that could be through a jury, that could be sometimes just through a very significant settlement where it's obvious from the amount of settlement that they're heard. There is a redeeming therapeutic thing that someone else has heard me and I do matter, and what was taken from me has value, and that's been recognized as mattering. It was huge in this wrongful death case that we tried, where they'd only been married 8 days, and there were insinuations that he just, you know, because she was a very large woman, and there was insinuations that it was kind of a fraudulent marriage, so he could try to get his immigration status fixed, and you know, that really cheapened. People really tried to cheapen her loss, and cheapened what was taken from her. And I think having a jury hear her, listen to her, I think just having her lawyers sit there and listen to her, I think made a huge difference, because I don't know that many people, other people had. But then when the verdict came out, I think her tears were really the affirmation of that she mattered. And that's what I told her.
Yeah. We had a very similar trial because I've...
You just had a bigger number at the end.
It doesn't matter. But yeah, I had a trial, and that one was in Ohio, and it was with someone. They took, the other side took just some cheap shots because it was like very, very overweight people. They made sure to bring that out. And I think that was the first trial that I actually used the words you just used. And I don't know if you internalized it or if you actually said those words, but I said that. I took what we're talking about and just talked honestly with the jury to say, you know what, when Jane's daughter, the anniversary of her death next month comes, nothing you or I are going to do that are going to bring her back. There's nothing we're going to do that's going to make her happy that day. But your verdict can let her know that someone heard her. So this is the idea of being present, right? So it's like me holding my mom's hand. Just let her remember, well, at least some other human beings know that what they took from me is of the utmost value. And that's really why we're here, because the other side will say it doesn't have that much value. Why do they say that? See, it turns it around. Yeah. It's not the plaintiffs that are coming and are greedy. It's why don't they recognize the value? What is the value of that? And because they're trying to hold on to their money. They don't want to pay they don't want to return the value of what they took, like the law says. They want a discount on it. And when I, you know, break the vase at the store or whatever metaphor you use, I don't say, well, you know, no vase is worth $1,800. I'm going to give you half of that, $900. No, I broke it and paid for it. I think people get that.
So what have you done to develop the skills or the practices to companion people in pain or people who are grieving?
Yeah, something that I've been doing, and it is intimate to talk about. When I say intimate, I mean just like very personal. And I know it can probably sound like woo-woo or a little wacky for people, but it's I find it very helpful. And that's to be present with my client in their pain, in the deposition, and to be aware of their energy. I mean, I know that's like a funny word to use, but we, you know, it's physically reality. We all have energy if we're living human beings. And so, again, boy, it's interesting to contrast how I practiced probably the first 10 years of my practice. And now, boy, it's been 27 years, you know, the last decade or so, quite different. I used to take a deposition and I would literally be working on something else or dozing or just kind of like in my mind thinking about dinner that night or who knows what. And now that, oh, I think about that and think, you gotta be kidding me. When they ask my client a question and they're answering whatever it is, or the client's crying, or pissed off because they asked something that they didn't think they should be asking, I make sure that I'm present in my body, first of all, that I plant my feet on the ground, that I center myself, and that I connect to their energy. So as they're asking the question, I want to be connected to them. And maybe there's no reality to this at all, but it helps my frame of mind at the very least to be there. And I think the client gets that, right? I'm very present. I feel connected to them. I'm trying to protect them and just, again, be present to their pain, to give them the strength, you know, to ground to the earth, to feel how that must feel and just to let them know I'm here. And so I'll even make sure that like my hands are maybe on the table where they can see them, you know, that I'm not doing something else, that I'm breathing. And I'll talk to my clients ahead of time about breathing. And there's going to be a pain, there's going to be emotion, and make sure, and I may even say, take a breath, Jane. And I'll model that so that they can breathe and keep talking and be there in the pain. If I'm present with them in the pain and not cowering, what it does is it helps insulate. One of the things it does is every deposition that you have in a case that's emotional, in every death case or some case where there's a tragedy, as soon as there's emotion, every single time, I can't think of an exception, what happens? What happens in your depositions if the defense is asking a question and your plaintiff starts to cry?
People want to stop it.
Yeah. Can we take a break? Sorry. I don't want, you know, and I think that it's well-intended that, you know, they give people a chance to gather themselves. And in addition to that, consciously or subconsciously, what I hear, and I talk to my client about this ahead of time, is, whoa, I'm getting paid by the hour. Like, I don't want to think about my kid getting killed. Yeah. Like, I just stop. Let's take a break. I don't want to go there. What I want to do is talk about things that are quantifiable. I want to talk about how many times you visited, how much your birthday presents, you know, you spent on them, and how often did you FaceTime. Like, let's talk about things that have numbers behind them. But if you want me really to be present to this, let's take a break. And so I talk with my clients and say, learn to breathe. I'll make them do it. Not just talk about it. Let's breathe. And we know from, I think of Joshua Carton when I say this, great trial consultant we both work with, that he would say that the voice comes on the out-breath, right? All you need to talk is your vocal cords vibrating as you're breathing out. So breathe in, breathe out. And as you're breathing out, even if you're crying, go ahead and talk. Tell them. And many times the other side, the defense, will say, let's take a break. No, I'm good. Let's keep going. And the purpose for that, because if you think that, you know, giving your client a break, that's kind of mean to your client, what do you think, that they don't go home and cry every night or every week or all the time? They're crying whether you see it or not. So why not let everyone who's involved in the case, including the defense, just for a moment, feel what that feels like? So don't bring out the tissues right away to stop the emotion. Don't pause the deposition. So I practice being present with that. And it's tough because, like you said, we want to fix it. But okay, I can't fix it. Be present with it. Just have a connection with my client, and here we are. And I hope, and I my clients have told me they feel supported, whether they know. I don't tell them that I'm sitting here centering and trying to ground to the earth. I don't say it exactly that way. And I feel a little, I don't feel embarrassed saying it, but it's, I know it can sound a little wacky, but that's how it works for me. And for others, it might sound other ways. You know, there might be ways that you think of God or divinity or the universe, but there's something to being aware of the energy that's present there and just being there. Am I making any sense?
You are to me. hopefully. Yeah. And another thing, you know, and I learned this from you and from Renson, is that, you know, I never really knew how to meditate before I'd went to a Zen workshop that you, Renson, and Josh Carton put on. And one thing I saw that was different than other kinds of meditation I'd kind of tried, like with an app or something, is that the Zen meditation is eyes open and you're just, at least what we were doing, focusing on breath. You weren't trying to repeat a mantra and distracting your mind, closing your mind, visioning things that aren't there. It was just being there in reality, whatever it was. And it's, you know, was difficult. It's still sometimes when my mind is racing a million miles an hour, it can be difficult. But learning to just sit there and accept life for what it is I think has helped me sit there and not jump in and try to fix, but listen and be part of what it is, which is what they really need anyway. That's going to help more than the trying to fix something that you don't have the power to fix. And I think that that exercise and that practice that I'm not as disciplined as I should be, but I do try to incorporate into my life has not only made me a better person, but actually probably made me a happier person. I'm not going to say probably, it has made me a happier person because I am, you know, no longer trying to have this unrealistic goals that can never be met. Like make my client happy after they lost a child. I can make them satisfied with my services. I can make them feel like they've been heard and that someone cares about them. But they're not going to be happy because someone took their freaking kid. That's not going to happen. And so, you know, getting rid of the illusion of what I can and can't do, and even the illusion of control at trial. I learned this from Sari de Lamont. Like, first of all, I try to go in with a mindset of I'm going to give everyone the benefit of the doubt. I'm going to assume that the jurors are there because they want to do the right thing, and they're taking time out of their lives because at the end of the case, they may not agree with me about what the right thing is, and I have to accept that. I don't have control over that, but they're there because they want to do the right thing. The judge. We may have different philosophies, but the judge thinks is going to do what they think the law requires and what they think is right. So I just have to trust them. I can't control them. I'm just going to trust them. And my job is to give them the tools they need to make the right decision. And if they don't make the right decision, that's really on them, not me. And it doesn't mean that I don't want to win. I don't care about winning. But when you take that responsibility off yourself, because, you know, giving yourself the responsibility for something you don't have control, which is what are, you know, in my jurisdiction, 10 out of 12 people going to decide to do. I mean, I have control about how present I am with them, about how well I prepare, how in the moment I am when I present, how real I'm going to be. That all I have control over. What the ultimate outcome is, I don't have control over. And so judging myself by that or worrying about the future when the future's not here yet, none of that is helpful. And so I work real hard. And I think about 85% of the way there of just letting it go and just enjoying myself being there. And it's so much more fun, too.
I love it. I love everything you just said on many levels. The one, the eyes wide open. Yeah. There's a misconception about the idea of Zen, that it's like just being calm all the time or off in some meditative, you know, waterfalls and rainbows. And that's not it at all. It's the eyes open as we meditate and watching what's going on. And that includes feeling the pain of what's going on in the Ukraine, yeah. feeling it all, the good, the bad. And I also loved that you've now incorporated, and it was seamless, where you said, and I want to be present and I want my client to be heard of what the other side took from her. That's excellent. That's been something that's very important to me, the Zen Lawyer Workshop that I put on with Rinson Roshi and Joshua Carton. I know you've been through it. And we're, after COVID and after not doing it for several years, we're going to, in October, in Toledo, Ohio. And this will be the first time we'll actually be at our new Zen temple where it'll be held. So there's options for people to either stay in nearby hotels or to stay in bunks for free at the temple. And if anyone has concerns about it, I can talk through it, what that entails. It's, no one's trying to convert anyone, I promise you. It's learning traditional Zen meditation, which, like you said, eyes open, watching your breath, and just being your breath, just being present without talking. What a great skill for trial lawyers to practice. And then to notice what's going on in your heart, in your mind. And then what we do is take that. It's not just meditation, but that's the core of it. Zen translates as reality. The word is reality. Just noticing really what's going on. Because so often we deceive ourselves in so many different ways. The delusions are what causes suffering. And so then we'll take that, though, and practice being fully present, giving an opening statement. We'll practice different parts of the case or how we can, some of the things like we've talked about, how to do a client prep with these skills in mind. So if anyone's interested, if you don't mind me promoting that, it's you can go to the zenlawyer.com is the website, and there you'll see our October dates, October 19th to 22nd this year, 2022 in Toledo, Ohio. Love to have people attend. If it's something that is just really meaningful to you and you can't afford the tuition, reach out to me. I don't ever want that to get in someone's way, you know, especially if someone's doing public interest work. But everything we do is really trying to help make the world a better place. And that's something else that's part of the Zen Lawyer workshop. And that's that what we do is for a purpose. It's to reduce suffering in the world. It's to do good things. And yes, that includes getting people money. I'm not ashamed of that. We deal with the psychology of money. Where do your earliest thoughts about money come from? Feelings about money? Does that interfere in what you do? And it's very important to me that, yes, it's about money and it's more. What we do has to be doing good in the world and reducing suffering. I'm not interested in spending time with people who don't have that intention. That sounds pretty harsh, but it's true.
No, I think those kind of boundaries are important to set. I think that being real about what we want to do and where we want to spend our time, and that means where we don't want to spend our time, is so important. I got that from you just on learning how to have the courage to say no to certain kinds of cases, because we have so much time, and where is my calling? What do I want to do? And to do that, I have to say no to things that aren't always easy to say no to. I will encourage everybody, and when it's not a religious thing where someone's going to try to convert you to a religion or ask you to practice a certain religion. Learning things, and you do a good job of tying it in. It's not just this esoteric stuff, but tying it in to the trial work. And at least when I went, it was a combination of the trial stuff and the meditative stuff, and some Aikido stuff back then too. I think, is that still the same?
Yeah. I mean, so first of all, like you said, Zen Buddhism's non-theistic. So there we have a Catholic nun that comes. There's people who are Jewish that come. There's a Sikh, the person that come. Like, there's no commentary on any of that. You can be atheist and come. Like, there's no commentary on theism or gods. It's really just learning Zen meditation. Watch your breath, be present in the moment. And Rinzen Roshi is also he's now a 6-degree black belt in Aikido. So we definitely bring those skills, being centered in your body, what they call in Aikido, your hara, and how to bring that in the courtroom, how to just be physically present in a way that's direct and fierce and compassionate at the same time. So we do that. Joshua Carton's part, definitely getting on your feet and connecting with jurors. So it's all, you can take the meditation and say, we need to use that to really be present to ourselves. And what I see most often, and I certainly understand this, is like our self-criticisms. So if you can notice your self-criticisms, then you can work on just getting rid of them. It's so important. So you're right. We will learn to meditate. We'll learn some Aikido principles, and we'll definitely spend time putting that into action. And how you prep clients, how you respond in the courtroom, how you do an opening. It's a workshop, not lectures. It's people doing work. I mean, there's sometimes when we're talking and you're listening, but yeah, it's definitely a workshop.
I would say for me, it was definitely the beginning of a step to a greater, the next level of trial lawyering. I had mastered a lot of skills. I had tried a lot of cases, but I felt that there was something that was incomplete in the way I was, in my results, and the way I was trying cases, the way I was working up cases. And I don't know if you remember, there was an exercise that Josh did with me, and I promise you that Josh had known me and had worked with me for 20 years. He won't probably not do this to you if he doesn't think that you're ready for it. But he had me articulate all of the things that were going through my head that I thought were holding me back from getting, you know, the full justice I thought my clients. And so, you know, one was, you know, you're greedy, you're not good enough, you're too fat, no one's going to like you, you know, you just want to buy in. And so he had one person stand behind me for each of my self-criticisms and kind of shout them in my ear, and I had to give an opening statement and learn to tune it out. And it was emotional. I mean, it was a good exercise, but I know that night I was going to go with a group of people to go eat and have a drink, and I'm just like, you guys go, I'm going to process this. It wasn't that I was sad, I needed to just be in my room, have room service, and just kind of be with myself and process what I'd been through. But it was really a beginning of learning to let that stuff go so that I can be present for my client and present with the jury. Cause I'm not now when I'm in there, I'm not worried about me, what's going to happen to me and whether I'm good enough or not. I'm just worried about what happened and what the story is and how can I help these jurors do the right thing. And it's just, like I said, I'm not going to say that 3 days and you're going to get there, but it's a step and it's a pointing me in the direction, giving me tools that I've used. So I really do encourage people to go, especially people that have been practicing for a while and you've gotten the basics down, but you just want to one, master this so you can really be present in the courtroom and two, to have a life that's worth living because it's more than about money and accolades and success, but to get rid of all the other self-criticism that keeps us from enjoying the fruits of our labor. I really encourage people to do that. It's been a wonderful part of my life and I thank you for it, Michael. And I hope that other people who are listening, some of them, if this you feel that this calls you, please register and go. I don't push many things on the show, but it is really personal to me. And the link will be on the show notes to register if you'd like to. And Michael, thank you so much for everything you do.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed our conversation, as always.
Thank you for joining us on Trial Lawyer Nation. I hope you enjoyed our show. If you'd like to receive updates, insider information, and more from Trial Lawyer Nation, sign up for our mailing list at triallawyernation.com. You can also visit our episodes page on the website for show notes and direct links to any resources in this or any past episode. To help more attorneys find our podcast, please like, share, and subscribe to our podcast on any of our social media outlets. If you'd like access to exclusive plaintiff lawyer only content and live monthly discussions with me, send a request to join the Trial Lawyer Nation Insider Circle Facebook group. Thanks again for tuning in. I look forward to having you with us next time on Trial Lawyer Nation.
Each year, the law firm of Cowan Rodriguez Peacock pays millions of dollars in co-counsel fees to attorneys nationwide on trucking and commercial vehicle cases. If you have an injury case involving death or catastrophic injuries and would like to partner with our firm, please contact us. You can reach DeLisi Friday by calling 210-941-1301 or send an email to DeLisi@cowanlaw.com. That's DELISI@cowanlaw.com. She will coordinate a time for Michael Cowan to speak with you in person or by phone to discuss the case in detail and see where we can add value in a partnership. This podcast has been hosted by Michael Cowan and is not intended to, nor does it create the attorney-client privilege between our host, guest, and any listener for any reason. Content from the podcast is not to be interpreted as legal advice. All thoughts and opinions expressed herein are only those from which they came.